My name is Chris Main, M-A-I-N. I'm with Major General G.J.J. Edwards, DSC, CD. And General Edwards was with the Royal Canadian Air Force during the Second World War, the RCAF in the interwar years, or after the war, I should say, and with the Canadian Forces after integration. And the date today is the 1st of August, 1979, and we're at General Edwards' home in, I guess this would be Saanich.
North Saanich.
North Saanich in, what's the estate called? The
Dean Park Estates.
Dean Park Estates. Lovely home up here on Mistdale Place. General Edwards, the last day I believe we got as far as you becoming the new CO of a new squadron. And I was wondering, first of all, if we could go through the procedure of you were selected by who to become what and that type of thing, if we could just go through that briefly.
I see here in my logbook, Chris, that my last bomber command operation with 428 Squadron, and it turned out to be my last in bomber command, in fact, was on the 6th of October, 1944, an attack on Dortmund in Germany. And I can't recall exact dates, but I remember on or about the 7th, 8th, or 9th of October, my squadron commander in 428, Chess Hull, who eventually became vice chief of the defense staff in much later unification days, told me that I was to appear before the AOC of 6th Group, Air Vice Marshal McEwen, Black Mike McEwen, and he said, I don't know why you're required down there, but you are to be there at such and such a time, and that must have been around the 8th or the 9th of October. I appeared at 6th Group headquarters, and there found, I think there were three other squadron leaders from various squadrons around 6th Group, and collectively we went into Black Mike's office, and we had a very pleasant and general chat with him. What I didn't know, and perhaps none of us knew at the time, was that he was sizing us up and was going to select one or more of us to be squadron commander somewhere in the group.
This would be what, a promotion to wing leader?
And this would be, we were squadron leaders, and this would be a promotion to wing commander. But at the time, we didn't know this. I had just turned 23, and short interview, had lunch there at 6th Group, then back to 428 Squadron, middle of St. George, and by the time I got back, I was told that I was to report to the heavy conversion unit to convert onto Halifax 3s, that I had been selected to be a squadron commander. I didn't know at the time what squadron.
Now that would be called, a wing commander would be called a squadron commander, is that correct?
Well, squadron commanders were mostly wing commanders. There was the odd group captain. Squadron commander, and there'd be several squadron leaders, squadron commanders. The confusion about rank and position is evident here. We understood it, but a lot of our foreign cousins certainly didn't, and I can understand why.
So in essence, you were having colonels, full colonels, half colonels, majors,
and majors commanding squadrons of various sizes and shapes. In any event, I did my conversion in 3 days, 12, 13, 14 October. I had flown a Halifax with a Merlin engine. This was a Halifax with Hercules engines, Hercules 16, Halifax 3. In any event, I converted and
little trouble converting, I assume.
No difficulty converting.
Would the only difference be the engine?
The engine. Well, the handling characteristics of the aircraft were a little different, and it was just a question of cockpit familiarization and a few a few circuits and bumps, and I was converted. Converted quickly because of my my background on Halifax 3s and Lank 10s.
You feel you were a little young, or?
Heavens, no. No, I was a very mature, experienced, sophisticated, et cetera, et cetera. The age didn't occur to me at all.
I was just thinking, looking back now.
Yeah, 23 was probably youngish, but I certainly wasn't the youngest squadron commander ever appointed. Have you ever learned what the youngest age was?
I think it was around 19 or 20.
That young.
I've heard there was a group captain, I think, at around 22 or something like that.
Yeah.
20, 21, 22.
Yeah, could be.
I think the wing commanders at around 19 and 20.
But pretty rare, though, I would
think. I would think so, yeah. Well, General Lane, of course, was, a group captain at, 24?
24, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, that's still pretty...
So he would have been a wing commander at 22, 23, yeah. I should think. I would think that on an average would be young. In any event, I took over 420 on the 17th of October. And
now, where was 420 Squadron located?
420 was in Tolthorpe,
which is
in Yorkshire, southern part of Yorkshire. Tolthorpe was one of three stations that formed. What we call 62 base down there. These terms, when I read them now, I can understand confusion. We know what we were talking about, but clearly nobody else did. 62 base, which sat at Linton-on-Ouse. It was a headquarters at Linton-on-Ouse. Linton-on-Ouse was one of the bases. Tolthorpe was another base. The third base was, can't remember. But in any event, three bases, six squadrons. I became OC of 420 on the 17th of October, and was instructed on appointment to the squadron that I was not to fly operations. I was to do briefings, arrange training programs, but I was not to fly operations. And the reason was there was a shortage of squadron commanders, and they just weren't risking me. Why me alone? I don't know.
Usually speaking, the squadron, or the wing commander, squadron commander, whatever you want to call them, would fly with the boys. Is that right? Prior to this time?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
The only guy who didn't fly would be a group captain. Is that correct? Or there'd be exceptions to that rule as well?
Well, the group captains were usually commanding officers of the station.
Stations, yeah.
And they were there in an essentially administrative capacity. And the wing commanders were the two operational commanders, and they flew with their squadrons. You didn't fly every operation. You may have flown one in two or three, but
now, would you have a left out of battle system like the Army did, where your number two, if your number one was, if the colonel, say in a regiment, was up with the boys, his major would be left out of battle on purpose, and then vice versa, if the major was up in the so that you would have continuity in case of casualty.
A squadron usually composed of two flights, and there were two flight commanders, squadron leader working under the wing commander, and one would always be left back on ground to run the show while the squadron commander and one of the flight commanders away, or the squadron commander would remain and two flight commanders would fly. Or maybe only one of us would fly, but you're quite right. We always had a staff on the ground.
There was a definite LOB, left out of battle.
We didn't use that term. It was just known. It was just known that that all three must not fly on the same operation. And indeed, there was a further directive. About that time, perhaps a little earlier, every now and then a squadron commander would form his crew from the leaders of the various sections, the leader of the nav section. Mm-hmm. The leader of the bomb aimer section, the flight engineer, the gunners. And it seemed to me that in about August or September, one squadron commander, using that practice, was shot down, and the squadron was gutted. The squadron commander went, and he had a crew of leaders, and suddenly wiped out. So the direction was that no one crew was to be composed of
your best
of your various section leaders. The section leaders certainly had to fly. They were operational true, but they were scattered through several crews. In any event, I ran 420 for I see from my logbook only 2 months from the 17th of October. I'm wrong. Only 1 month and a bit until the 27th of November.
Now, were you promoted to wing commander?
I was promoted to wing commander sometime around the 17th of October, but was with the squadron for just over the month. Thinking back, it seemed a lot longer than that. But
why? Because you weren't flying.
Clearly, it wasn't. Yeah, that was possibly it. I was unaccustomed to remaining on the ground and doing. Largely an operationally oriented administrative job, running a squadron, as opposed to flying sort of every third night. It seemed to stretch some considerable period in any event. But then I was notified by telephone that I was going over to be wing commander operations at 62 base. Now this was the base headquarters that sat.
Before we get there, sir, at 420 squadron, your duties as wing commander would be what, determining who would be flying, when you say administrative, I'm just trying to think of some of the things that you would do.
Yeah, operational administration. Well, you were the boss.
You called the old man, or what?
You were called the old man. And you said, and you felt like the old man. You knew, you were it.
You were aging rapidly, though, I guess.
That was it.
But what types of administrative, I know it's a catch-all, but I'm thinking, would you be, what, coordinating all the stores, all the armaments, all the...
No, that was a station responsibility. The station had the armament section, the, most of the technicians, armament, supply, the various social services around the base, messing.
Mm-hmm.
The squadron commanders concentrated on essentially operational and training matters and did the operational briefings, set up the training programs.
So you would do the briefings, for example, for a raid?
Now,
would you be instructed which course and all those kinds of things to...
Yeah. You would be notified by the intelligence section, usually.
Well, it wouldn't come down from 6th Bomber Crew?
It would, but it wouldn't come directly to the CO because your communications net right in your squadron huts was pretty primitive stuff. The classified stuff went directly into the intelligence section that had scramblers and, what am I trying to say, a general security apparatus. So you would be notified by your intelligence section that group briefing, this was 6th Group now briefing squadron commanders, group briefing was to be held at, say, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And that's all you were told. You didn't know what the target was or tactics or size of raid or timing of raid or any of these things. So you would go across to you and the other squadron commander, and if you were wise, you took one or two of your flight commanders with you as well. Would go across to a briefing given by the operational staff up in group, and you there in the intelligence section of your station would be the target, the route in without tactics, and all the additional information you needed to properly beef your crews, flak concentrations. What else would be happening in your area? A general picture, and the squadron commander would make notes, and then the line to 6th Group would be opened, and each station and CO would check in as being there personally by name, just CO 420 here, and then you would be given the latest tactics. To be to be followed going into and out from the target. You would be given time on target, the kind of spread you had, everything necessary to allow you, the squadron commander, now to go back and brief your crews. And if you had a briefing, say, with 6th Group at perhaps 3 o'clock, you then would set your squadron briefing in sufficient time then to allow your aircraft, well, your crews to be briefed, your crews to eat, to be equipped with MAOS, escape gear, and parachutes, out to the aircraft in good time to take off to meet specific times, crossing the coast, going in, etc., etc. The squadron commander had backed that up and told his squadron when they should, when the briefing would take place. For instance, we were in South Yorkshire, and if we were heading south that night and crossing the south coast and saying going in over France, we could hold our briefings up to perhaps a half hour later than the squadrons would in North Yorkshire. There'd be a half hour's flying more for them. So you'd brief, you decide, let's say with a planned takeoff, say for 8 o'clock at night, you'd plan to brief at least 2 hours ahead. So a 2000 takeoff would call for a briefing at 1800, and the briefings were quite short.
How much of your own discretion could you use in these briefings? Like, I guess what I'm getting at is that it sounds almost as if it's just a messenger system. Your position is a messenger system as opposed to you.
You had no independence, because your squadron had to fit into the master group plan, and the master group plan had to fit in with the bomber command plan. And you remember that the bombers were essentially just shuttling bombs from base to target. So the whole thing had to be coordinated and controlled centrally. You're right. A squadron commander had, in that sense, no discretion whatsoever at all. He was told...
Bomb at X altitude on X course at X time?
That's right. And...
Did you feel thwarted in this position?
I don't remember a sense of that.
Would you rather be flying, I guess is what I should be asking.
You'd rather be flying, but you'd certainly be flying on specific instructions as well. The kind of briefing you gave to the crews, if you flew, you were in fact giving the same briefing to yourself. But there was very little flexibility there. Your flexibility came in your training programs.
What kind of training program would you institute then?
Well, you'd control. Remember, you had very new and very old crews, and the whole range between. So, your various crews needed various kinds of training. You could be arranging. Straight circuits and landings for the very new crews who still perhaps weren't entirely comfortable in the airplane, and you'd send them up to do circuits, landings, and emergency procedures to more fully familiarize themselves with the aircraft, and to be better up to speed on emergency procedures, say two and three engine landings and two and three engine flights. Or fire affiliation, or bomber affiliation, or straight nav runs to bring the navigator up to speed.
Would there be an airspace control system in England?
Yeah, but it was terribly primitive in those days. We used to just take off and go, and you played the. When I say take off and go, if you were going to be doing fighter affiliation. For instance, you had a specific time to rendezvous with a fighter aircraft from some fighter squadron, fighter wing. Or if you were going to be doing practice bombing on a bombing range, you were given a specified time over the bombing range. But for the rest, you really flew in that airspace with great freedom of action. And indeed, when I went back to UK many years later in 1957 through 59, RAF was still essentially operating under those philosophies. Airspace was free, and you flew. There wasn't the tight control that I came to learn about, really, back in Canada, where you were on instrument flying when you were down in built-up areas. Mind you, the whole of UK was built up, but back home in built-up areas, you were flying specific radio ranges, and you were using specific navigation aids, and you were controlled very positively from the ground. Such was not the case during World War II, and I repeat, when I went back in 57, I discovered that, by and large, it was uncontrolled airspace in which we operated over this heavily built-up area. But it worked. It worked remarkably well.
You weren't dodging your chums when they were up for a joyride either, though.
It's hard to know when you're in cloud at night how close you were coming to somebody else. And I suppose there were more near misses than we ever knew about. But,
I could just see some haywire and a spit just going for a, you know.
Yeah, well, of course, the spits, the fighter aircraft tended to operate higher than we did anyway. So there was that kind of vertical spread. And certainly a couple of squadrons operating from a single station would broadly coordinate. Mm-hmm. Both squadrons wouldn't go up for a major night training exercise at the same time in the same area. But to return to your earlier question, squadron commanders in bomber command in the operational field tended to act as, to use your term, messengers.
Well,
they passed the word and they briefed the crews.
And in turn would be responsible that the crews followed the word, is that correct?
Yeah, but once a crew was airborne, he was an independent entity.
Yeah.
Or it was an independent entity. The captain of that crew was under instruction. Whether or not he followed it was his own responsibility. But
did you have much case where people just wouldn't say bomb at the right altitude, or were they too afraid of?
You rarely heard of this, and
okay. Well, I guess what I'm getting at is you see the movie and the guy says, "Oh, I'm taking my squadron in at 8,000. To hell with you."
You know
this sort of nonsense.
I think you use the word. I think certainly in my experience and talking to other crews since. There was nothing to be gained by this. You knew that the spread in time and altitude was designed for your protection, so you wouldn't run into one of your own. And there was little apparent value to
push it.
Well, adopting an independent course and. No, I'm sure there were. I'm sure there were variations and violations, but those variations would have to be for in the mind of the aircraft commander for his crew's protection, yeah. His aircraft's protection, and it was up.
What
to
about
him.
Your responsibility when the squadron commander when your squadron took off? When they left the ground, your responsibility for them had pretty much gone by the by, or what?
It had ceased because they were then under control of bomber command.
Under bomber
command. And the radio officers would be listening out on a bomber command frequency. Bomber command could decide, for instance, that the raid should not take place. They could scrub the raid. I'm not aware of Bomber Command ever deciding by air to shift the target, say.
Would you have primary and secondary targets and things like that?
Yes,
Yes.
Yeah, you were briefed.
So let's say something was clouded in or whatever, you just couldn't get a fix, you would go somewhere else.
If you couldn't get a fix, then you, as aircraft commander, would be listening on a frequency for master bomber instruction.
That'd be Pathfinder's, I guess.
And that would be a Pathfinder responsibility. But Pathfinder, of course, that Pathfinder force tied very closely to Bomber Command headquarters again. And it would be a master bomber, I suppose, reporting back to Bomber Command that the target was completely obscured. We'd go to a secondary target. But the secondary target would probably be fairly close in. There wouldn't be a major airborne diversion.
180 degrees, turn left,
never,
and everything.
Never. No, it would be moving perhaps maybe 25 or 30 miles north or south to a secondary target. And usually MEP would tell you very early on that there would be some doubt that, say, you would be able to attack Dortmund, but if you flew north of that band of cloud that they expected in there, you could attack target X, Y, or Z, alternate. But that was a fairly rare event. The Pathfinder force, if the target was obscured, very often would release floating parachute target indicators. And they were bright burning. You could either see them through the cloud, or they'd float very slowly down through the cloud. And as the bomber force came up, you would be bombing the center of that concentration.
Pathfinders really improved your accuracy. Is that correct?
Well, we didn't have the equipment.
You didn't have all the elbow and all
inherent in the aircraft to do anything but bomb on target indicators. Particularly at night, there was nothing. There was nothing to see. You were looking down into a black abyss until some target indicators appeared. Very rarely would the night be bright enough and the ground clear enough to allow you, an individual bomber crew, to pick out a target. You very often bombed an enormous city like Stuttgart or Berlin, or Kiel, without ever seeing much on the ground, other than the target indicators.
Now, you remained with 420 Squadron for approximately a month, you're saying. Now, was this considered your second tour, or would this all be part of your first, or how
was it? It was still considered part of my first and subsequently only tour. I went to base, I see, on the 27th of November 1944, and was wing commander ops there. Now this was kind of an obscure job that none of us really knew much about. The base headquarters was commanded by an air commodore, and in the case of 62 base, there were three group captain station commanders, and on each station two squadrons under the base. And the wing commander ops job, by and large, was to, what would the term be, coordinate, translate, consolidate, standardize operational policies and practices.
So you're making the grand transition then from a flyer into an administrator.
Into an operational administrator.
Yes.
You know, as opposed to an administrator of personnel and logistics matters. This is administration of operational matters.
Yeah, but you're really making the transition at this point, though, is that not correct?
Quite unaware. I fully expected this to be a sort of what we call a screen job. It meant you were off direct ops. It was a period of rest, if you like, in a sense. And I fully expected to be going back to operations sometime after unspecified time after. But what in fact happened, I remained 3 months at 62 Base, Linton-on-Ouse, Yorkshire, and then was transferred to 6th Group headquarters.
Now where?
Allerton Park, also in Yorkshire. And I became an operational controller. And an operational controller acted as an operational policy tactics group briefing officer at the group level now. And whereas as a squadron commander I'd be receiving operational instructions at briefings down at station level, I was now giving these instructions by telephone to the several squadron commanders in 6th Group. And that 6th Group period lasted through VE Day, which of course we weren't anticipating. I was in 6th Group from the 15th of February, 45, to the 26th of May. And then, have we covered enough here?
I think so. Other than just what was 6th Group headquarters like, I guess, is what we could...
It was a handsome old building, the home of the I can't remember what his title was, the owner, but he had offered his home, or had been directed to offer his home, to be headquarters for 6th Group, and we took over we called it the castle. It was a very, very large country mm-hmm. home in a handsome park. We operated from it and around the we operated from the castle. The ops room was in the castle. The AOC's office, the various group staff officers operated from there. We lived and messed in a group of Nissen huts scattered around Allerton Park.
What was the social life there? Anything to speak of? Or?
No. If anything, well, let me see. The demands you could never really count on a day off. You of course all your action, or most of your action, still was at night with the odd daylight operation. And 6th Group was the next link in the chain directly to Bomber Command.
Mm-hmm.
So you manned the ops room in group headquarters 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And you had times on, times off, but your times off, if an operation was suddenly called by Bomber Command, was cut short, and you were called right back in. So you really couldn't stray too far from Allerton Park. Oh, you could go out to dinner of a night. You could go into we were fairly close to Harrogate. We were within striking distance of Leeds and York, and you could do a pub crawl and a dinner of a night. But I don't recall. I was only there. What was I there? I was only there about. Three and a half months. I don't recall any leave in that period, and I think I got only perhaps one complete day off, and was told no matter what you have a day off, and was able to go off and play some golf with some friends in the outskirts of Leeds. But the rest of the time you were really on 24-hour call, and this was now you see very, very late in the war. When some relaxation on reflection might have been possible, but there certainly was no evidence that I can recall.
What about the personalities there? Did you come into contact with any? I mean, this was Canada's I mean, Six Group was Canada's big contribution, I guess we could say.
Well, it was an identifiable formation, a major yeah. formation. Of course, Canada's contribution throughout the Arctic was enormous.
Yeah, but I'm thinking of the Canadianization policy and all these other things combined.
Yeah.
The Six Group was the RCAF, in essence, overseas.
Well, plus a couple of major fighter wings.
Oh, yes. No, I'm not trying to diminish anything else, but I'm saying it is the major one. It is the preeminent.
This was the RCF bomber group, and it was the largest single operational formation identifiable as RCF over there. Quite right. Well, Black Mike McEwen, AOC, World War One flyer, a very stern figurehead. He tended to keep to himself. He had a couple of air commodores working for him. One on the administrative side, and one on the operational side. Roy Slemon, who eventually became chief of the air staff.
Air Marshal Slemon.
Air Marshal Slemon was an air commodore then, and he was
He was permanent RCF.
He was permanent force. Ralph McBurney was in there, who retired as an air vice marshal some 10 years later. Reg Lane was known as Air One. You already have interviewed Reg Lane. Reg was a group captain then, at the ripe age of what? 25? And Reg was really our boss. I was one of three controllers. Jeff Hull was a controller. I was a controller. I've forgotten who the third chap was in my time frame.
I was working for General Lane.
Fine. We had done our SFDS flying together. I knew him.
He'd have his DSO and his DFC, and
yes,
he had all the gongs and rank
and a gore. Yeah. Reg, we become very, very close friends since. We weren't close friends then. For no particular reason, time just did not seem to permit.
Mm-hmm.
We were spending most of our time on the business.
Was General Lane a workaholic?
A workaholic, exactly. Worked extraordinarily hard, and whereas there were three controllers on constant call, so we had some flexibility. He was the single Air One, and was expected to be in directing. Operational consulting in terms of tactics with the operational staff at Bomber Command. But I don't even remember. VE Day occurred during my time there. I remember we had a hell of a party that night, but I think even before that. Have you discussed the formation of Tiger Force with anyone yet? Does that ring a bell with you?
I've heard it.
Well, in these late days of the battle of Europe, the RAF and the RCF were already considering deployment after victory in Europe, deployment of bomber command forces to the Pacific
Sea,
to pursue the attack on Japan. And earlier on, there'd been a call throughout Six Group for volunteers, very much volunteers, for Tiger Force, and I was one of them. And the plan was to, after victory in Europe, to deploy Six Group back to Canada for more training and possible re-equipment on what types of aircraft we didn't know. Remember, we were mostly on Lank 10s then. And the first group to go back to Canada was 64 base that had contained my former squadron 428. And I see here that on the 26th of May, this is after VE Day now.
We're talking about, what, 2 weeks at that?
How's that?
We're talking only about 2 weeks after. A week and a half after.
Yeah, right, yeah. Right. I was sent to 64 base to act as, I see, I have down here, to act as dispatcher for the move of 419 squadron and 428 squadron, all in Lank 10s, back to Canada for redeployment, eventually to Tiger Force in Japan. And
so you had no time to reap the fruits of victory there.
Very, very brief. Very brief, because we were now going to be doing something that we really hadn't done before. Damn, few of us had done before. We knew the route back to Canada was going to be from UK down to the Azores, and then directly across to Goose Bay in Labrador, and then down into Nova Scotia. Well, we had navigating experience throughout England using good navigational equipment, precise navigation equipment, G, and H2S over in Europe when we could, in fact, use it. But now we were going to be pushing across some fairly vast expanses of water for us,
mm-hmm.
with pretty crude navigational equipment. So we needed some training up for that.
So would you get that from Ferry Command, or?
Ferry Command was sent down some crews to bring 419 and 428 up to speed. And up to speed wasn't much, but we were told what kind of nav aids to expect en route, what kind of homing devices we would have, transatlantic procedures, etc., etc. All of which took at most a week. Because we started back, I started back from Linton to St. Mogens, from St. Mogens to Lodges in the Azores, and then to Gander. No, it wasn't Goose Bay, it was to Gander. And then finally into a place called Skadook in New Brunswick. And I started back on the 17th of June.
Well, did we pack an extra gas and things like that, or?
Nothing special there, no. We just took off with full tanks, and of course we weren't carrying bombs, so we could carry max gas load.
Trying to get anything back from the UK to Canada?
Only the stuff you could fit carefully into the aircraft. And there wasn't a hell of a lot of room by the time you had a crew of perhaps about eight now. You packed your own bags. I remember one of the jobs as a dispatcher was to say was to write the aircraft loading instruction, the dimension of the maximum piece you could get into the aircraft, and here's where it was to go with such and such.
Someone was trying to smuggle back a Jeep or something.
No way. You couldn't. I'm sure we were tempted, but there was no way to get a Jeep up into a Lank.
But you still have a fair amount of space with the Bombay all emptied out, wouldn't you?
Yeah. I don't think we put much in the Bombay coming back. We may have put some of the luggage up in there. We may have carried some spares up in there and some spares packs, you see. But you couldn't get anything of the size of a vehicle up in there at all.
No, I wasn't thinking of that. I was thinking things that you'd picked up along the way.
Oh, you brought that.
You brought all your
goodies, and of course, great excitement. You were flying home. You weren't going to have to sit around and wait for a boat.
Mm-hmm.
And this was.
This would be one of the first ones back too, right?
17 June, I think that was the first wave. We subsequently brought. I think something like 10 squadrons worth of lengths back. But I got back on the 19th of June into Skidook. So just to
how was your reception, sir?
Just let me recap. From the time I left 428 squadron, my main squadron, if you like, I'd been OC of 420. I had become wing commander ops at 62 base, controller at 6 group, and dispatcher at 64 base, and the period was something less than 7 months. So I had 5 jobs in seven months. Fair movement, but it seemed as natural as sin, no problem at all.
Now, would you be flying back yourself?
I flew back with a crew, but the crew had only one pilot in it.
Oh, right.
So I took the wheel. I think we split the time more or less evenly, particularly on that lake from St. Lodge's in the Azores to Gander. And that
would be a long haul.
Well, you know, looking at it now, it seemed like forever. But it lasted 6 hours and 30 minutes. And I had done many, many operations that lasted a lot longer than that.
Because we were over water and heading home.
You're over water. It was completely unfamiliar. You knew that you were flying into an area that had, you had been told, had a great deal of fog. We really had no precise landing aids in those days. What I'm really saying is you were flying into a completely new environment. So your apprehensiveness was really greater there than it had been on many of the European operations.
Take a pause. We're back. Time's marching on again. General Edwards, you get back to Canada. What was your reception? I mean, you're flying in with a bunch of lengths and victory in Europe and smart blue uniform, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Well, we landed in in Gander to a pleasant reception. Gander had been an operational base on the east coast of Canada, Eastern Air Command, and